Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. Today we have Tim Lee from Fractonium. How are you today, Tim?
I'm great. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me on your show. It's great to be here. It's an interesting time for Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency market, so we can all have a bit of a smile on our face, I think.
I am. I'm smiling at the moment. Very much. I'll have to introduce my co-host, Carl. How are you today?
Yeah, very well, Michael. And yourself?
I'm very good, mate. Very good. Leading to Christmas. I'm excited. So, well, good. Well, mate, why don't you kick off the first question to Tim, mate?
Absolutely. And like you said, Tim, we're in a very interesting state of the market when it comes to cryptocurrency. But I guess before we jump into that and start discussing that, I'd like to hear a bit more about Fractonium, because this is a really, you know, I guess a way of future-proofing investments in a lot of ways as well. So can you give us a bit of a background on Fractonium and how it came about?
Sure. Basically, Fractonium is a fractional funding platform, is the way that we've looked at things. And it's very much that it's the idea of being able to divide up assets into very, very small pieces and taking a lot of the cryptocurrency technology and enabling international transfer of those tokenized assets or those fractional assets becomes a potential reality. And the cost effectiveness and the power of cryptocurrencies enabling assets and tokens to be programmed, linking in your identity, linking to a whole variety of things. So it's very much, it's about fractional assets and looking at different layers of funding around those assets, all based around tokenization. I mean, I'm an ex-banker of, embarrassed to say, 20 odd years, and got deeply involved in the blockchain about 5 years ago, and very much trying to put these together. I can see where the technologies can blend together to actually present solutions that we're going to be heading into, especially as a result of the pandemic. So it's really fractional funding of assets is the easiest way to describe it. And we'll talk about various examples as we go through, I'm sure, but that's really where we're at.
Is that also linked to anything, for example, like any markets, like you're talking real estate, art? I know that gets talked about a fair bit. Fractional of anything?
Is that essentially, yes. I mean, it's, we're in discussions with people for fractionalizing gold, fractionalizing corporate bonds, looking at fractional art. Any form of asset can be created as a financial instrument. I mean, the challenges relate to some of the regulatory issues that exist within established countries. But given where we're at with the pandemic, I mean, the desire for change depends on how deep the problem is that people are facing. And so I can see that as the economies globally continue to suffer, we're going to see new ideas coming to the fore and people saying, hang on, let's look at different models. We need to embrace things. And so one of the core elements of what we're looking at is how do we bring communities into funding assets and projects? It might be, for example, pieces of art. For example, the Brooklyn Museum, I think it was, actually put up for auction a whole variety of their pieces of art valued at millions of dollars because they couldn't fund their operating expenses. So the idea is if you can fractionalize the piece of art, keep them in the actual gallery and get the patrons and customers to buy those fractional pieces, you then engage your audience far, far better rather than just selling the painting to a rich multi-millionaire that's probably going to just put it away in a bank vault, just accumulating wealth. So, it's all these types of things that will happen in the future. But a lot of it is about getting the regulation to come together.
I mean, it's interesting you talk about regulations because, I mean, it doesn't sound the same as something like derivatives where, we're packaging things up and providing it as a contract. But I guess the financial sector has always been very resistant to any sort of change without regulation, hasn't it? And it sounds like what you're doing actually isn't that far from what we're doing now, but it seems like you're sort of encountering a few issues in that space.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really what is a financial service, and what is an investment product? And that's the key thing. If you've got a sort of a collective investment structure, then that becomes highly regulated. That's where a lot of initial coin offerings in 2017 fell short of the law in terms of they were funding, you know, it was actually funding a product in the expectation they were going to get growth from the value of that token that they used as the investment. And so the because tokenization and digital assets is such a new concept, the regulators can only regulate what the lawyers and the government tell them to regulate. And so it's about going through that whole governmental process to actually say, well, hang on a second, these digital assets are different. I mean, it's the same product, but it's a different structure. And so, for example, in Malta, they've created the Virtual Financial Assets Act. Yeah, back in October 2018, it was launched. Looking at all the Virtual Financial Assets Act is called, where they're looking at specifically identifying digital assets. And I think it will happen where assets will be able to be fractionalized, but it's about making it really easy for people internationally, for example, to buy. It might be, let's say there's a private public partnership, maybe there's a museum in Sydney, or let's say the Opera House, that might be the easiest way of doing it. How many millions of people would love to own a small piece of the Opera House? Now, you know, imagine going forward, you tokenize the Opera House and you make those tokens available as reflection of a fractional ownership, and those are available internationally. That becomes the actual value of those tokens to the Opera House and to the governments increase in value, because you dispense with a liquidity discount. You get much, much more clearly defined global markets.
Would you say that you're a platform that enables digital currency or digital movement of ownership kind of things for other people? Are you more of a wholesaler, or are you?
It's more, I mean, we're creating the tech for it. So we're the tech layer, rather than actually sort of saying, you know, here's the, here's us, come and get us. We'll you know, do all the regulation and that type of thing. I mean, you know, the financial intermediaries and a lot of bankers right now already have the relationships with investors. So there's no point in reinventing the wheel on that side, because investment relationships are all about trust and about many years of working together. And so it's very much, there's no point in trying to create right from the get-go a whole raft of new investors. It's about how do we make banks, the broking, the investment banking space, all these types of things. How do we make it easy for them to take advantage of the benefits of this tokenization? So it's a tech layer that we're providing, but we have to be mindful of the adoption of the tech, and the adoption of the tech will be predicated on the regulation. And it's one of those things that it's only when there are major problems that governments will say, hang on a second, let's speed this regulation through. I mean, if we look at a case in point, taking a parallel, you know, the COVID-19 vaccine has been produced in record time. And as Carl was saying prior to the podcast, it normally takes 7 years, for the vaccine to come to fruition. So, you know, when there's a need to get things done, then regulation will speed up. And I think we're getting to the situation where we're almost getting a confluence of challenges linking into the insolvency in economies, the lack of confidence in governments printing money, in terms of, markets not meeting the economic reality. So I think there will be areas where suddenly it becomes, how do we actually embrace new structures? So for example, if governments, instead of just printing money for the sake of it, if they made available public assets and said, okay, you fund these, fund 50% of, a Museum of Contemporary Art, whatever it might be. It's the idea that you can actually raise funds without actually having to, print more money in the true sense of the word, and that having a detrimental effect upon, upon economies and potential inflation and that type of thing. So I can see private-public partnerships working really well in the future, and how quickly that future comes depends on the pain points they're facing.
So in that essence, I guess, is it more of taking that sort of almost like a crowdfunding approach, but Fractonium really blends the private and public sectors together? I mean, traditional crowdfunding is, private companies with, startups will come and launch their platform, but we're talking about things on a much larger scale here, aren't we, Tim?
Very much so. I mean, because I've come from the banking space and have, you know, worked deeply on new products within the banking space, one of the key things that I sort of have spoken about to a number of different parties in the banking space is new models of funding the capital stack, as we call it. And the capital stack is typically debt and equity, all right? Where, let's take a commercial property. Let's keep it really simple. Commercial property values, yeah. Let's call it $1 million. Keep it really simple. The commercial banks will often make available a commercial mortgage, but the most they will make available will be 70%, right? Rather than a residential property, which they can go to 80% and beyond with certain insurance products wrapped in. So the idea is the closer the bank is to 70%, the higher the risk from their perspective. So if one looks at the idea of fractionalizing a layer of the building for both equity ownership or asset ownership, plus also a debt piece that would be fractionized, with the idea that instead of the bank having 70%, they have 50%, and there's a layer of 20% that's tokenized and made available, providing an annuity for retirees, whatever it might be. In that particular case, the bank exposure is now only 50%. So as a result, as an ex-banker, when you reduce the risk down to a level where if you can't get out of an exposure with a 50% loan to value ratio, you don't deserve to be in business. And so what the covenants, as it's called, of any loans, the actual terms and conditions, you can make those really light. So instead of saying, if you default on the payments, we're going to repossess the asset very quickly because we're at a high risk level. At 50%, you negotiate up front, give us 6 months to put the property on the market, give us 6 months to refinance it and have a controlled situation. And sure, that layer, that 20% layer that is the debt piece, I mean, that's tokenized. So, you know, people can actually offer to buy and sell those and all that type of stuff. But the main bank risk, or the risk to any business, is the bank pulling the plug. And if you can make it easier easier for them to say, okay, we'll give you 6 months, then everybody wins. You know, so it's all, these are just examples of where the future can go.
So whereabouts do you do business at the moment? I know, obviously, you operate from Sydney, Australia, but where do you do most of your business with Fractonium at the moment?
Yeah. We're in discussions with banks in emerging markets. We had discussions with the Big Four here in Australia and internationally. And especially, I'll say especially in Australia, because that's going to be relevant to the majority of people listening. I think there isn't a need for change with the banks here. There's no dramatic need. Their lunch isn't being eaten tomorrow. You know, it's sure, it's going to be a long-term issue, but there's no drive for change. In emerging markets, where number one, digital systems aren't that extensive, in terms of dealing with customers, looking at security behind any assets that are being made available, all these types of things, you've got a bit of a clearer landscape. And also with the pandemic, developing nations are going to be suffering really badly. And if countries and organizations within countries that are suffering badly, if there are really bad economic consequences, the governments there are maybe in threat of default on their international loans to the International Monetary Fund and all those types of things, they're going to be prepared to embrace new ideas if it can actually help their objectives. So it's very much, we're focusing on emerging markets because that's where the early adopters are. In Australia, they're not early adopters. You know, it's when they're brought to the party kicking and screaming, when they need to effect great change, that's when they'll actually start saying, oh, okay, let's look at this now. So they're going to tend to be laggards. And that presents an opportunity because clearly from a business perspective, if we're getting early adopting clients, which is obviously what we're really sort of focused on winning some of those contracts, it then tests the technology, which then gives the incumbent banks here the opportunity to say, wow, this is a really good idea, rather than us actually working through it, let's just acquire. So that's the That's the methodology behind the madness.
If we look at the current... Oh, sorry, Tim.
Sorry, Phil. Sorry, my apologies.
That's right. I was going to say, it's interesting, and I think you're right, sort of looking for the early adopters before moving forward. If we look at the current conditions in globally, you know, we've got close to $1 trillion being pumped into the European economy, $1 trillion in US, and multiple billions here. We were talking about this earlier. Eventually, that, you know, that's going to have to come back from the citizens in some cases. And a lot of people, I think, at the moment are more focused on surviving rather than diversifying investments. So do you see Fractonium as a way to sort of assist people with maybe getting their foot in the door from that perspective? You know, by tokenizing assets, they have more of a chance of, you know, chipping away and starting an investment portfolio that way as well?
Yeah, I think if one thinks of it in terms of where initial coin offerings were, and I know we're going back a bit in history, but whenever initial coin offerings were made available, there were people globally that were investing in initial coin offerings by tokens that actually powered the platform that was being created. And those were being exchanged globally via, you know, cryptocurrency exchanges. You could, you know, exchange those, and you could move money between exchanges through cryptocurrency and digital currency in minutes rather than the international time taking 3 days, or between about 1.5 and 3 days right now. So it actually does, if one takes that methodology and applies it to different asset classes, you can get international investment where you can get a balanced portfolio. So it might be that somebody wants to look at balancing, say, a week housing market in the States, for example, if they're in the States, with a strong market in Australia, whatever it might be. You can actually move your tokenized assets across the globe, and you can actually shift and ebb and flow and make those investments dynamic at any given time. So yeah, it's very much taking the strength of cryptocurrencies, as has been seen, and putting them into a methodology around the existing assets.
Do you see that happening from, I guess, almost like a peer-to-peer exchange as well as maybe a token to other currency or token to fiat currency happening? So are you looking at, you know, multiple ways of exchanging this type of tokenization?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the biggest issue with any form of tokenization is the volume of liquidity that one's going to get. So it's about... that's why we're sort of very much providing the infrastructure to make it happen. But ultimately, it's about the tokens being made available in a unified version. So it might be a commercial property token globally that might exist, for example, where that actually is what is known as fungible. So you can take that token and use it in the States, in Australia, in the UK, whatever that might be, to represent different structures of assets. So I think, it can give an awful lot of flexibility, certainly for the future. But it is about facing the big elephant in the room of regulation and making this happen, and that's always a challenge.
I know in the last 12 months with this 2020, there's been an insane amount of money printed, right? Some people you walk down the street understand it, some don't, as we all know in most cases, but we're talking in excess of $30 trillion, for example, globally. It's insane, right? It's ridiculous. And we're seeing some major issues with that, like kicking the can down the road, but we can talk about that soon. Do you feel that situation has brought your use case for your business forward, along with the pandemic and the COVID situation? Do you feel that's going to create more demand quicker in the future?
I think it all comes down to the adoption of the technology. And it's like anything. I remember many, many years ago, because I've got a few gray hairs, I remember pitching in Silicon Valley. I'm getting embarrassed to say this, in 2000. And we were, yeah, I was out of the UK and working on a video email marketing structure. And I remember going to pitching at an event organized by the British High Commission, yada, yada, yada. And we were all pitching, and there was this annoying American investor at the back of the room. Right? Not that all Americans are annoying, but this particular guy he certainly redefined the definition of annoying. He kept on shouting out, is this a painkiller or a vitamin? Right? In terms to every pitch. And it actually resonated with me 100% because, you know, if you've got a headache, you want a painkiller right now. If you want to have health, a healthy lifestyle, you're going to change the way in which you, you know, you eat healthy food, you do more exercise, et cetera, et cetera. The painkiller is immediate. So it's about where is the biggest pain point? Because the pain point will drive early adoption. Because if people have got a headache, they want that tablet right now. And so it's very much, you know, all the printing of money plus the pandemic and the economic fallout that's actually happening is going to force governments to rethink a whole lot of things. And I mean, you know, there's talk of Bretton Woods 2, there's talk of the great financial reset going on, which would be a conversation in its own right. But when there are dramatic problems, that's when the technology will be adopted quicker. And if the pain point is big enough, regulation, you know, the barriers to regulation will be put aside and they'll say, this is a priority, get it sorted. So yes, I think in answer to your question, the printing of money, the potential lack of confidence in money, the lack of confidence in government, you know, and a whole variety of ways in the economic fallout are going to drive new adoptions of ideas and fractionalization, I think globally will become a major influencing structure.
You might be well positioned for 2021 then, some new opportunities.
I think we might be well positioned for about 2030, the way the regulators are going at the moment. But because it's about finding those early adopters, and you know that's and getting that adoption. So we're in discussions, as I say, with some early adopting banks. We've been talking to for 15 months. You know, this is an indication of the sales cycle. You know, and getting to the point of sort of exchanging, you know, sort of contracts, and you know, and just prior to COVID, we had a verbal agreement of a contract for fractionalizing gold to help bank the unbanked. Of course, that was verbal. COVID happened. This particular bank in an international environment had a border with China at the time. This was mid-February, and they just put everything on hold. They've got 18,000 staff and 500 branches. And they had to, and 6 million customers, they had to work out how the heck are we sorting that out. So suddenly innovation didn't become their highest priority. So, yeah, it's interesting times, I think is the best way of saying it.
With the current situation, I guess the other big thing that's happened has been a lot of wealth transfer. I mean, we've seen a huge amount of small businesses and, you know, small, medium enterprise simply just really fold because of the current restrictions that have been brought on by the pandemic. I guess in a lot of ways, though, Tim, these are kind of the people that are going to be looking for a new way to transact and to do business, aren't they? Because at the end of the day, they're going to lose faith in the current system. I think in Australia, we've been quite lucky, but come March 2021, I think we're going to start to see the implications of that. For me, what you guys are offering is very tempting. Do you think a lot of people are going to become disenfranchised by the way things are happening and look for alternatives such as yourself?
I think ultimately they will, but a lot of it's about education, all right, and making people aware about what's actually happening. I mean, you know, recessions are very, very Darwinian anyway, all right, in terms of recessions clear out the weakest operators in any industry. And whether we like it or not, recessions are an economic reality. So in part, you know, a lot of the failures that are happening are part of that cycle. And then, you know, new companies arise and different models come out of it. But I think, you know, for small and medium enterprises, it's not this sort of model, I think is not going to be most appropriate for them. I think it's more about the funding layers, you know, the banks, the investment banks, investors, sovereign funds, a whole variety of different elements. I think the smaller medium businesses may be the beneficiary of it, but I think it's more a layer for the banking sector and the international banking sector rather than small businesses per se. Because it doesn't really give them enough added value. Whereas, you know, for banks, for example, if you fractionalize an asset at 50% loan to value ratio rather than 70%. There's, you know, banks have to report on risk weighted assets, and they have to apportion banking, more banking capital for higher risk assets. So if they can actually reduce the amount of banking capital, you know, it becomes really a powerful component for them. So I think the beneficiaries are going to be that middle layer of funding rather than the ultimate end beneficiary will probably just get better quality terms, but it'll be the banks and the banking layer which will actually get the benefits.
Does it also give them a platform, I guess, to kind of forecast, you know, demand generation? So say, for example, I could say, all right, I want to build a project of some infrastructure, hypothetically. I'm going to tokenize that and gauge interest before I actually break ground and have, like you said, have to fund that through traditional methods like, you know, the banking sector that's going to weigh on a risk and an LVR. And, you know, potentially I've then got to pay additional insurances to make sure I'm all covered. Do you think that there's a use case of something like that as well?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'll give you an example. One of the things that we started off looking, this was in September 2018, we started looking at art. We looked at models for art. And one of the things that we were looking at was how can museums potentially buy a painting from an auction up front? Okay, in a similar way that we're talking about, yeah, which can be applied to any asset. But it's the idea that we were looking at the structure of bringing the audiences and the customers of the museum to say, okay, you come in, you can actually own 75% of a Picasso, let's say, all right, collectively. The museum owns the remaining 25, 26%, probably 26% for governance structures. But it's the idea that then the museum, instead of actually putting out you know, putting out their budget for one Picasso, they can then buy four Picassos for the same budget. Right. So if you replicate that model in terms of if you bring communities together in terms of funding, it can actually be a situation that a government can get four times the leverage for any funds they put in, or a private enterprise can actually keep a lot of their own powder dry. You can get a far greater return on equity by looking at different structures. But it's the idea that with that art piece, for example, that they would pre-commit prior to the piece going to auction. So then the museum could actually then commit to the art. And then as soon as the hammer goes down, bang, all the smart contracts go through and it all resolves itself. The museum spent 25% of their budget on one painting rather than 100%. They then keep the piece of art in the museum, which then means that they can then bring and engage with their customer audience that owns a piece of that art. And if those parties that own that piece of art are then curated via the museum to make them feel special, you have special events and all sorts of stuff for those that might own it. So you can actually bring communities together. It's almost the Uber of banking or the Uber of funding in some ways. So I think it does open up new types of models. Does that answer your question? I think a bit of a roundabout way of answering the question, but I wanted to give that example of something we were working with in practice.
With the actual, I've done some research leading into today, of course, and with Crunchbase and looking at the private investment of blockchain, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and Ethereum investment. There's obviously you can't get the private numbers, but you get what they publicly state on the website. But it's up to about 30 billion to 40 billion USD of investment globally in blockchain. Obviously, yep. Private investment, obviously not above that, would push that higher. What I'm finding is when you're looking at the technology side with your investment, what are you using behind the scenes as your blockchain background or platform? What underpins it?
Because we're working with developing nations, we're running smart contracts like a lot of applications out there. And smart contracts are the way of programming money. That's the best way of saying it. So a lot of traditional applications are using Ethereum. Now, the price of moving Ethereum, a token via Ethereum, I mean, the cost can range from $3 up to $30 for to move something internationally, which is insane. So we're using Algorand as our core platform because they're generating 15,000 transactions a second. The costs of transaction are fractions of a cent. So what it means is, with the with the bank in Asia, in one of the developing nations, where we're looking at the idea of a local customer of theirs being able to buy 0.1 of a gram, which is $5, with the idea they can buy 0.1 of a gram and then build that up to get enough ownership to then go into the branch and pick up a gold coin. That's basically the way the model worked. But if you've got a $3 transaction fee in Ethereum, it's never going to work. We had to explore a solution that was fast, was cost effective, and actually had a good set of people and ideas behind it. Now Garand has got one of the best management teams in the blockchain space, all ex-IBMers, and one of the key tech guys, Silvio, whose surname escapes me, was one of the creators of a thing called zero k snarks, a technology for privacy, basically. Really smart people, and they've set things up so that they're members of the International Security and Derivatives Association. They're Sharia compliant, in other words, for Islamic countries. And they've really thought about their technology for financial services. So that's the core tech that we're using to overcome that problem of, if you have Ethereum and it's going to cost you $3 for somebody to buy $5 worth of gold, that's just insane. It just doesn't work. The economics don't work.
No, and it's good to see you using Algorand. Last time I looked, it was ranked 45th or 60th around that on the rankings of the cryptocurrency. But if you look at it, it just looks like another altcoin. But behind the scenes, there is some fundamental.
Oh, there's some really, really good stuff behind it. Really good stuff. Yeah. Very impressive. I mean, obviously not financial advice, but I think it's a very, very solid project. And I would urge everybody to have a look at it in more depth. The tokenomics the economics of the tokenomics aren't perfect, which means the price won't go up to any exalted heights, I don't think, in my opinion. But the technology is fantastic, and the people behind it are just, they're top shelf.
No, it's good to see. And look, the most important thing is actually people understand that these altcoins do have utilities. There actually is something going on, and it's good to see something like yours.
Yeah, I mean, it's
the business side of it, not just this technical stuff. You've got people throwing money into these coins, hopefully they, go somewhere,
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we're old enough, or I'm old enough and ugly enough to have bought into quite a few sort of pre-ICOs back in 2016, 2017. And a number of those projects just aren't in existence anymore. I mean, I bought in for the ICO, I made my money, and that was it. I moved on to the next one. I mean, only a couple did I actually retain, retain some of the tokens. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of the projects were half-baked before. But now, there's still some very, very half-baked projects out there. But there are some really interesting projects in the DeFi space, the decentralized finance space, which is going to be a precursor to dramatic disruption for financial services globally. But that, again, we could be going down a very deep rabbit hole, because decentralized finance has really only mushroomed in the past 3 to 4 months. It's interesting. I mean, a lot of the cryptocurrency projects historically were just dogs. And you have to pick the fleas out of the dogs, it's just a nightmare. But things are getting better, I think. I mean, I think next year is just going to be insane.
Yeah, I think everyone looking forward to the back end of 2020 is probably not going to be too happy when halfway through 2021 things are very interesting. I think, we spoke about this before we started the podcast, but what the interesting thing has been, and I know Michael tracks this pretty closely, is the strength of the crypto market in the past few months. And maybe that's just in relation to, we've spoken about this earlier, with stimulus being created in all of these countries, I think people might be flocking to alternatives except for fiat. So, I mean, is that something that you're also, looking at as well, Tim? Looking at different cryptocurrencies? I know, you've got quite a finger on the pulse there.
I mean, personally, I'm an investor in the cryptocurrency space. And I do trade. I try and swing trade as far as possible. so I don't have to stare at screens all the time. But yeah, I mean, it is one of those areas that there are some really good projects that are coming out. There are some dogs, as we were saying earlier on, but yeah, I think a lot of people, in 2017, especially a lot of retail folks sort of got drawn into the crypto space by means of Bitcoin, seeing Bitcoin going up to 20,000 or getting, you know, rising quickly. And the usual sort of, the millennials wanting their dopamine hits from sort of making easy money. They were sort of sucked in. And by drawing people into the headline of Bitcoin, it draws people into alternative coins. If they sort of say, well, what's Bitcoin all about? And then they start digging deeper, then they understand what's actually going on and look at alternative coins. And that's why I think where we're at with Bitcoin right now, where it's up at about, where we're at now, just under 23,000 US. I mean, you know, a lot of people at the institutional level have seen Bitcoin rise substantially, and they're putting in a bucket load of money, and they're going to come into the alternative coin space progressively. As they actually really start to do their due diligence around Bitcoin, they'll then sort of understand what else is out there and what returns can we get. And, you know, they'll put a small portion of their capital into other altcoins. They're going to back the main ones like Bitcoin and Ethereum to begin with. But yeah, the altcoins will have their day in the sun, I think, anyway.
And you feel this year, obviously, Bitcoin, I think the conditions were so rich to make it go forward and go to those new heights. And obviously 2021 is predicted to go on a significant bull run, not because of some dodgy behavior, but because of genuine fundamentals that are driven from this pandemic. Is that your view on it? Do you see this printing of money being rocket fuel for Bitcoin?
I think, I think one of the key things that is happening is the confidence in the dollar, for example, and other sort of national currencies is beginning to take a nosedive. I mean, this whole idea of modern monetary theory of, you know, just print money as long as we keep inflation below 2%, roughly, you know, that's just kicking the can down the road. And I mean, all this government stimulus, which is really important to have. I mean, I fully understand that. And all the money market operations and the propping up by the central banks, it's kicking the can down the road in terms of problems. Now, we're in a lucky position because the velocity of money is not that fast. In other words, if you put money in, people aren't going and spending it and buying new cars and spending consumer goods. They're using the money to survive. So as a result, we're not going to get the hyperinflation, in my opinion, on the basis of the economic conditions we've got now. If we had a really buoyant time and everybody got this money, that would be a different situation. Everybody would be chasing too many people chasing too few goods. So I think with all the printing and lack of confidence in traditional structures, it is definitely driving alternatives. There's no question about it. And I think, when we consider the government's globally are looking at what is known as central bank digital currencies, where they're taking the powers and benefits of cryptocurrencies and turning those into a sovereign currency, where you can program your local Aussie dollar, you can program your US dollar, you can program a digital yuan. What that means is it gives a tremendous amount of power and control by central banks over their economy. So I think the dialogue is beginning to happen around the digitization of finance. And so I think, you know, the pandemic has brought around digitization to the fore, and the digitization of finance is part of that natural dialogue. So as a result, Bitcoin as that digital finance, which was originally set up as a peer-to-peer currency that could be transmitted without going through a financial institution. If you look at the abstract of the white paper, which I would recommend all of your listeners to go out and read, it's only nine pages long with one page of maths. The rest is fairly simple. It really shows the whole ethos of digital currencies and what can be done. And so it's this power of digital finance, this power of international transference of cash, and the power not to have to rely on the US currency. I mean, the US dollar is the global reserve currency. 91% of all international transactions are carried out in US dollars. Now, if you can do that in a different structure, you know, via digital yuan or via Bitcoin or via any other form of digital currency that is coming out, it actually opens up a new world. It opens up a completely new landscape for a new world. And that essentially, in my view, is what Bitcoin represents. It's a proxy for all of this that's going on. But it also represents something that's very powerful that, you know, a lot of, you know, gold and others don't have, is that, you know, it's not owned by anybody. Oh, it's owned by nobody and owned by everybody in terms of the community. Mines Bitcoins, which then powers the whole network. I mean, without getting too heavily into the detail of it, just to try and keep it very simple. So what it means is independent computers all around the world are actually mining Bitcoin, and that provides a security and structure for a peer-to-peer database. That's probably the easiest way of saying it without getting too heavy. But that structure, it means that nobody owns, the community essentially owns Bitcoin, which means a government doesn't own it, an individual multinational doesn't own it, or an individual doesn't own it. So that means it's a global currency, and the infrastructure is, you know, incredibly secure. I mean, you know, if you think of the, when you get into your, you know, owning Bitcoin, there's private and public keys. Don't want to get too heavily into the detail. The bottom line is the private key is the key thing, which is basically like a key to your safe. There are more combinations than there are grains of sand on the planet for the actual private key. So for hackers to actually hack Bitcoin, you know, just isn't going to happen unless we get deeply into quantum, you know, quantum computing further down the track. But it will take several years for people. I think it's something like, I forget the exact number, because it constantly changes, but it's in, you know, hundreds of years, computers working at the same time to crack a private key for somebody's Bitcoin. So it's just not going to happen. So as a result, it's very secure, but it's also incredibly transparent. You know, every single transaction that's ever occurred on the Bitcoin network is available for anybody to view. Doesn't mean that I can see that the Bitcoin address belongs to Michael or belongs to Carl, but I can see that Bitcoin has gone from an address, say my address, to your address. And that is completely visible to anybody that wants to look at it. So you've got this transparent structure of data, which if you consider where we are with the gold market and with the silver market, where, you know, there's just so much, I'm trying to think of the way of saying it without getting sued. There's so many challenges, let's say, in the gold and silver markets. This has got complete transparency. So I think, you know, it's Bitcoin is reflecting all the mess that's going on, but also it is actually providing this store of value that nobody can actually control. Right? You know, other than yourself, you own your Bitcoin, but nobody can actually control it unless we get to the stage where governments decide they might want to ban, you know, exchanging Bitcoin for US dollars or something like that. But I think when we get to that stage, there'll be enough powerful interests that have actually bought so much Bitcoin, they're going to say, we've got big lawyers and we've got big fat checks, leave us alone, you know.
It is interesting because I think the government did, you know, look at this and see it as a threat. I know the ATO, for example, ran quite a few projects. And now, Michael, I mean, most of the banks are also running crypto-based projects as well. And I guess, like you said, the only way that really this can be compromised is if there's a mapping of key to person and then it's an exploit via the person, not directly via the key. So my opinion would be, I think we might see more government influence trying to map who owns what amount of Bitcoin and sort of, you know, then leverage that way potentially.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the Bitcoin community has to recognize that they will need to build in an identity layer at some stage. For example, and I mean, obviously being based in Australia, this has become particularly important. It's illegal for anybody in Australia to trade privacy coins right now. I mean, we could go on to, offshore exchanges and trade them. But yeah, we can't trade Monero, we can't trade Dash, we can't trade Zen, a whole variety of products. So governments could do something in a similar vein with Bitcoin, or they could try. And so it's very much, it's about, you know, where does the Bitcoin community on the one hand meet with the regulation on the other hand? And there'll be, you know, both parties will be coming, you know, they'll be pulled to the party screaming and fighting and saying, no, we're not going to do it. But I think eventually there will be an identity layer, I would say, especially as we get central bank digital currencies coming to the fore, because what governments and central bankers don't want to have is the ability for there to be seepage. In other words, stuff they can't tax or stuff that can go to, you know, to fund terrorism. And so, you know, the identity layer, it's got, you can just see that coming. And the maximalists, as they're called, the hardcore Bitcoiners, will fight tooth and nail, but eventually there'll be a point of capitulation where it's either you do this, or the governments might say globally, okay, we've got 3 months to do it. If you don't do it, then Bitcoin will not be able to be exchanged. So I think there'll be a lot of ebbing and flowing and fighting, and you know, institutions who by that time will have put a bucket load of money behind them will say, hang on a second, you can't disrupt our investments. You know, these are pension funds that might, you know, that might be compromised. So, you know, it's, I think the genie's out of the bottle. And I think if they were going to do it, they should have done it back in 2009 and squashed Bitcoin before it started.
Interesting. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, are they going to go with the save the children or the terrorism route, you know, to try and nap this down? But I guess we'll have to wait and see.
I think it's just going to be about tax, to be honest.
Yeah.
That's going to be the key thing. You know, I mean, terrorism, don't get me wrong, terrorism is terrible, and anything that can stop it is fantastic. But I think, you know, tax, I think, will be their number one goal. And then number two will be the softer side of terrorism, I think.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think even if they sort of exploit it as a terrorist-related activity, it's still going to be taxed, because at the end of the day, you know, this is a large amount of, I guess the best way to put it would be financial value that's being traded without the government taking their piece of it, right? And I think that's kind of what's got a lot of people alarmed. And now it is becoming more mainstream into the fore. And now that we have more enterprises investing in this space, I think that's going to raise more flags up towards government that, you know, if enterprise is taking this seriously, then maybe it's something we need to invest a bit more time into as well.
Well, I think from a tax point of view, if the governments globally decided to do basic calculations, they will understand why they have to get involved. The gold market is $9.5 trillion, roughly, there or thereabouts. The Bitcoin market, about $350 billion, or maybe $400 billion now, all right? So there's a long way to go. If the Bitcoin market was the same size as the gold market, in other words, $9.5 trillion, each Bitcoin would be worth $428,000 US, which in Aussie terms is probably about $600,000 or so. So, you know, if these institutional funders, the early adopting corporates and all that type of stuff are going to be putting their money in, there's going to be a lot of value created. And that's a lot of taxation dollars.
Well, it's funny. So you said the genie's out of the bottle. A lot of people on the street are still saying it's a fad. It's going to go away. You're an idiot for putting your money into it. There's still that side of the fence going on. I think we've moved past that now. There's people still saying that. So in 12 months' time, based on institutional investment coming in, we're seeing public companies in the US putting their reserve cash into Bitcoin, or you know, 20% in some cases, which is a large amount. And they're using very much OCO desks, or using particular desks to do that to make sure it's not manipulating the price and causing these massive spikes. But in 12 months' time, what do you think, Tim? And obviously, it's not financial advice, but what do you think?
It's not financial advice. This is absolutely
not financial advice. What's your
opinion? Okay, as long as we've got that out of the way, that's good. well, put it this way. I'm going to be committing 70% of my SMSF into the cryptocurrency space. I will manage it very tightly myself. I would not. It would not surprise me that if we didn't see Bitcoin at 100,000 at the end of next year, because the sheer volume of institutional money that's trying to get into this space is absolutely huge, and that's just the stuff that people are talking about publicly. You know, in the past 2.5 months. Well, you know, since October the 1st, when Bitcoin was at $10,600 US, and it's now at, I keep on looking, $22,940 US, that's a 2.5 times increase, roughly. Oh, yeah, so just over 2 times increase in the space of about 8 weeks. And I think, you know, it's just going to be absolutely insane. So that's why with the institutions bringing their money in, and that's even without the major pension funds, which can't get involved because there isn't a lot of regulated options. In fact, very, very few. The only Bitcoin ETF that's ever been approved was in the Bermuda Stock Exchange in September this year. So institutions who actually invest, pension funds and that type of thing, cannot commit to funding or to actually investing in assets that are unregulated. So there's all these trillions of dollars that are waiting to sit on the sidelines. If you just get 1%, it's about $550 trillion. If you get 1% into the market, right? Then 1% of their assets put into the cryptocurrency or the Bitcoin market. You know, that's $5 trillion straight away. You know, it's just, I mean, because if you look at on the flip side in terms of the supply as well, and you know, some of your audience may not know this, but you know, the maximum number of Bitcoin that will ever be produced is 21 million, and that will be completed in 2140. So think of those numbers. That's 21 million. Now, 18.5 million have already been mined, right? So we've actually got in the region of about 2.6 million Bitcoin that will be produced by 2140. In other words, 120 years. Now, out of that 18.5 million that have actually been mined, 3.5 million have either been lost or not accessible. So we've got a net circulating flow of 15 million Bitcoin that are in a market where over the next 120 years, only equivalent of about about 2.5 million out of 15 million will actually, you know, new coins will ever be produced. The disconnect in terms of supply and demand is just absolutely insane. I mean, I've put out an article on this, which is it's a long article, about 17 minute read, unfortunately, sort of examining this in more depth, which I'm happy to make available to your audience if they're interested in viewing it. But it's the disconnect in this market is insane. And that's why I think the end of next year, it wouldn't surprise me to see $100,000. And that's why I'm putting my super, well, 70% of my super, and even that's perhaps a bit higher than most people would like. And, you know, but I'm keeping a really tight rein on how I actually manage it to make sure that I, you know, don't lose.
I'm in a similar situation. I know that. But what I'm finding at the moment is using that crypto now. I've moved ahead, a lot of people have, to use it as collateral. So companies like BlockFi, who have positioned themselves to take on collateral for loans to buy property, for example, with your Bitcoin or with Ethereum, for example. Yeah. What do you see as collateral by this time next year? Will there be more, maybe not necessarily retail banks, but more institutional banking that will allow collateral for loans? Actuaries will be backing.
I mean, banks will make available funds for stock portfolios now, right? But there's always a challenge because there's the, you know, stocks move up and down. So as a result, you know, your loan to value ratio might be 50%, something like that, to take into account those fluctuations. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies can be very volatile. I mean, just, you know, the day before yesterday, it moved by $1,500. It was just insane. And that was it falling. And that fell in about an hour or something. So the volatility is always the challenge when you're converting into US dollars or Aussie dollars or something like that. So I think they will probably initially partner with people to provide a white label, you know, within the than the banking fraternity, although the banking fraternity do have to, do have to actually sort of look at the idea of how do they look at custody of the Bitcoin, because that represents their security. And that's always a big concern, in terms of if you've got a hardware wallet, a thing like a Trezor or a Nano Ledger, which stores your Bitcoin, what happens if that gets compromised? All of a sudden, you've lost all your money. And often, these are, people are subject to phishing scams and a whole variety of bad actors doing bad things. So custody is going to be the biggest issue that the banks will have. So I think they will probably partner with others, providing there's an insured structure that leads to custody being protected or something like that. And they'd have to hedge that in some way, using the futures to hedge against the volatility in some structure. I mean, I think these things are on their way, I can't imagine HSBC, for example, welcoming an 83-year-old granny in and saying, "Do you want to buy some Bitcoin?" You need your private key. It's just not going to happen. But I could be wrong. But I remember just trying to teach my mother how to use Skype, and that took God knows how long. So I think it will happen, but it's all about custody and having reliable custody that's insured.
Wonderful. Well, Tim, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate you coming on board and sharing your insights, as a mentor with over 20 years' experience and a multiple years' experience and talking experience as well in the crypto market. This has really, really been insightful for us. For everyone listening as well, we'll be providing Fractonium's information as well as Tim's information and links to the articles that Tim mentioned earlier. But Tim, again, on behalf of myself and Michael, thank you very much for attending today, and we'll definitely have to get you back in the new year as well.
No, thanks, Carl and Michael. I really appreciate your time, and you do some great stuff. You're doing some great stuff together, so keep it up. It's all about educating parties, to understand more about it. And I mean, certainly in the new year, we're going to be launching some what we're terming as empowerment labs that will actually give organizations, both here and in developing countries, with insights and into what's actually going to happen with the digitization of finance and how they can actually seize those opportunities. So, I'll forward you some details of that when we're ready to launch it.
We'll get you back on for sure. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Appreciate your time.
Cheers, Tim. Thank you.
All right. See you. Bye.